For the week of September 6th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 19, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And on the road heading to Toronto, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, that's right. You're headed to Toronto.
Really? Are you in your car?
No, not literally, but I am. I'm heading to Toronto today.
Well, don't forget to tell everybody up there at that festival that they can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
I will.
Okay. And, you know, Telluride was this week.
I've never been. I always forget about that.
I went last year. It's a beautiful festival. It's in the middle of nowhere, Colorado. And if you drink wine on the first day, you will pass out because it's like at 17 trillion thousand feet. But it's a beautiful little old ski town, mining town. Tom Luddy and Gary Meyer put on a great festival every year, and it's usually the first stop for many Oscar-winning films. Last year, I saw the world premiere of Slumdog Millionaire there, with Danny Boyle sitting there in the audience.
No kidding.
Well, that's a very unusual thing for Telluride, though, to launch an Oscar-winning movie. I mean, they're not known for that. That's a pretty small...
intended for this to be an Academy Award-winning movie, did they?
No.
They just thought it was a cute, small little movie.
But Telluride's not known for launching Oscar winners, is it? It's just a really fun fest.
It has become known for launching Oscar winning.
No. Name one other movie.
A little film called Brokeback Mountain. Another little film called...
That's just because Khan turned it down. I don't know. I still don't think of Telluride as the source of Oscar winners. Wow.
Capote, Into the Wild, Babel, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
The Diving Bell premiered at Cannes.
Yes, no, but I mean, it features these...
No. That doesn't count. Then the New York Film Festival is also a launching for Oscar... No. Being the second or third or fifth place to show a movie doesn't make you the launch pad for an Oscar movie. That doesn't count. You don't get credit. You have to be number one. You have to be first and gets credit for Diving Bell.
I didn't know that Cannes said no to Brokeback Mountain.
Yes, they said no to Brokeback Mountain. They said all these great, great Ang Lee films or put them out of competition, and then they put... Taking Woodstock in. Their makeup movie
what
was
in
taking
the hell?
What's interesting about Telluride is that it's very hard to get to because it's not near any major city. You fly into Denver and then you have to fly to another city and then you have to take a 4-hour car ride or a 2-hour car ride. It's a pretty intense it's like an all day affair getting there. But that they don't announce their lineup, which films have been selected for the festival, until you get there.
And that's right.
And
wait, why not?
It's part of their charm. It's not about the, you know, it's all about the whole feel and atmosphere and event, not so much as like seeing big movies.
That's right.
Yeah, but can't people just sort of figure it out because you start to hear from filmmakers that their movies have been accepted?
It's just not that important. It's just a quiet little festival. It's really fun. It's really elite. It's really such a special setting. It's really just the pleasure of the weekend, and it's low key and not... It's not a heady prize-winning atmosphere like Cannes or a lot of pressure to launch a movie like Toronto. It's just a very cineast sort of film festival.
Oh, fun and charm. Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, actually, Anne Thompson, if you were following her blog, she took the charter. There's one charter every year from Los Angeles to a city very close to Telluride, but it's still a 2-hour drive afterwards. She received the lineup while on the plane. And it includes A Prophet by Jacques Audiard, An Education, which is getting a lot of buzz on Twitter and blogs. So that film from the UK seems to really be, it was a Sundance favorite, and it's definitely gearing up for awards season. The remake of Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, directed by Werner Herzog and starring Nicolas Cage, which also is premiering at Venice. Bright Star, the Jane Campion film, which Michael, you and I saw in Cannes. It's the film about Keats, I believe.
Yes.
Coco Before Chanel, directed by Anne Fontaine out of France. Dreadful.
Oh, it was at Cannes. It was dreadful.
Okay. Fish Tank, directed by Andrea Arnold, another Cannes entry, as is The White Ribbon, directed by Michael Haneke, which you and I again saw in Cannes. Samson and Delilah, I saw in Cannes, directed by Warwick Thornton out of Australia. We talked about it, I think, on episode 4. It's a great film. The Last Station is getting a lot of play. It's a biopic on Leo Tolstoy with James McAvoy, Paul Giamatti, and Helen Mirren. I'm actually looking forward to seeing that. A much-anticipated film that is screening at Telluride is The Road. It screened earlier in the week at Venice and got panned. It's based on Cormac McCarthy's novel.
I have to apologize.
No wonder it got panned.
Oh, Cormac McCarthy. That's a good book. It's fun. Oprah picked
Boring.
It. Well, I have to apologize about Coco Before Chanel. There's several Coco Chanel film projects, several. And that actually is the one starring Audrey Tautou of Amelie. And I actually saw another Coco Chanel movie starring people I don't even know. And it was at Cannes.
I would see Audrey Tautou read the phone book.
I don't get her at all. She's so boring. No, she's not charming. She's whimsical. There's a difference.
Oh, I like whimsical too.
Oh, I thought Amelie was one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
You're fired.
Okay, sorry, Sperling. Go on.
Pauline Kael was fired from, I believe it was Red Book or Good Housekeeping for panning The Sound of Music. And he may have just crossed the line again with pan charming and delightful
Amelie. She had to compare Amelie and The Sound of Music. Sound of Music, classic.
It's one of the greats, absolutely.
Speaking of charming and witty, I don't even know what the adjectives we were using there were, but this was my way of saying 7 minutes into the show that we have some very special guests coming up. Sal Nunziato, who is a music blogger working out of New York and who used to own and run NYCD, one of Manhattan and New York City's most, revered independent record stores. We also have, joining us from NPR a little later on, Bob Boylan, who, after directing All Things Considered for 18 years, is now the podcast host for All Songs Considered and is one of their musical folks over there. I guess before we get our guests on the line, we should probably talk about box office, though I don't know how much you want to talk about it.
I want to talk about Telluride, just one more thing. Isn't Paranormal Activity going to be featured there?
Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Yes, it is.
Have you guys seen this? Because I think this sounds fascinating.
No.
No, it strikes me as yet another Blair Witch Project type film. Of course, Blair Witch Project is 10 years old at this point.
But that was a really good movie before all the hype. Like, people who saw that movie, I think it premiered in Sundance. People who saw that in Sundance were like completely, they'd never seen anything like it. It was amazing. And that's actually, it's that word of mouth that got so many people to go see it. But Paranormal Activity strikes me as sort of the same. I mean, it's been 10 years. I mean, it's not a knockoff anymore, really.
Right. I mean, the film is effectively about an unmarried couple harassed by paranormal forces and their attempts to uncover the culprits. It was made for $11,000 in one house, and Paramount picked it up, hoping, I guess, for another Blair Witch Project.
Well, I think it sounds good.
The interesting thing there, in my opinion, is that they didn't know whether the film would actually make it to Telluride, so they had no place to put it, and instead they just showed it in an outdoor theater, which is a very interesting way to see a film. I saw The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, I think it was. Is that the name of that film, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that there in the outdoor theater last year, and they showed this one there. The film showed up just 2 hours before it was supposed to be screened.
Oh, you know what? That was in the show notes. I think that was... That was interesting. That actually reminded me of something that happened to me when I worked at William Morris. I had a film print that was going to like a film festival in Chicago or something. It wasn't a major one, but the mailroom forgot to send it. So my boss was just screaming at everybody just to scream, and I was like, okay, I've got to figure this out. So we ended up buying the print a seat on a plane. It's sad. Somebody went and like sat with it. And then we got like a helicopter and a police escort, and it made it to the film festival with like 2 minutes to spare.
That's awesome.
I know, isn't it?
Did you go downstairs to the mailroom and say, I'm sorry, but which one of you wanted to become an agent?
No, see, I don't play that way. Like my boss and like some other assistants were like just screaming at mailroom people. But I'm like, I don't care who wants to be an agent. I don't care whose fault it is. I just needed to solve this problem.
And you did. Yeah.
And I did. And I never yelled at anybody. I didn't have to. They knew what they had done.
No wonder you're not an agent.
I know, right? I just wanted to solve the problem and get the print there. And then I remember the next day I got this gigantic bouquet of flowers from the film festival people. My boss was so pissed.
Does your boss still represent, what's his name?
My boss doesn't work at William Morris anymore. My boss, if you're represented by my boss, it was like joining the witness protection program. Like that. There's a reason why you said what's his name. Because yeah, no one's ever heard of Wes Bentley.
Oh, wow.
That's who you're talking about, right?
Yeah, but he did represent Nick Cassavetes, who was in the news this week, and I know we talked about him last week.
I don't think Cassavetes is even at William Morris Endeavor or whatever anymore. I think he's at CAA, maybe? I don't know. But no, I think that the fact that he's suing New Line is pretty awesome.
Yeah, he's suing New Line, as Patrick Goldstein pointed out in his piece in the Los Angeles Times, because he wrote a, I guess a, he adapted a 60 Minutes piece that was called Peaceable Kingdom. It was about an elephant preserve, and he took the story in a direction that New Line did not want to go, and everybody felt that the story was a nice little family movie about elephants in Africa, and he decided to take it to a much darker place. The studio said, hey, thanks, but no thanks. And they just kind of went on without him.
But that's not the entire story. He agreed to write this draft because he was attached to direct this movie.
That is true.
A lot of directors will give you a, you know, free draft because they're going to direct the movie. And it's kind of like almost writing like their draft. It's sort of what they're doing. And then he turned in this draft, which was, yeah, a little bit darker than was intended. And instead of saying like, well, this is a little darker than we intended or whatever, talking through it, they're just like, nah, we're not going to make this, bye. And he's like, well.
Well, they are going to make it just without him.
But not with him. Yeah. So he's like, okay, well then, you know, pay me for the draft and pay me for the fact that I've turned down work while I was attached to direct this movie and writing this draft. So basically he wants to get paid for the draft and for his time. And I don't blame him.
Absolutely. Yeah. He should never have agreed to write the draft without something firmer as far as being attached to
direct.
Yeah,
I wonder about that too. Like, it's got to be something in writing.
It's like, you want me to do a draft, you got to pay me. I'm delighted I'm attached to direct, but we'll work out the rest of it later.
I love the way Patrick Goldstein refers to the film as an elephant orphanage drama.
Yeah, I know. That's hysterical, right? I read that. I'm like, what?
Well, he also takes a couple shots at Variety here. He says, sometimes you have to wonder if Variety is in the business of reporting the news or just reporting as little of the news as possible.
Ouch.
And
no, I totally disagree with him. I think this is it. This is the news. This is what happened. What does he want?
Well, I think he was upset that they didn't talk about the fact that Nick Cassavetes was basically an in-house New Line director, that he directed The Notebook, which we talked about last week, a New Line film. He directed three or four other films, which were New Line films. And
none of those people are still there anymore, right?
Well, no, none of them are there.
Yeah. So
besides,
it's a new
first of all, who cares?
Well, he says, if Variety expects to be taken seriously as the showbiz paper of record, you'd think it would at least dig a tiny bit deeper the next time it runs such a flimsy account of a filmmaker's dispute with a studio. Because most of the facts and details that we've been talking about, discussing right now, those are all the facts and details that Patrick Goldstein himself dug up.
Mm. Yeah, but Patrick Goldstein is, even though he hates to be called it, a blogger. And Variety is a trade paper. So Variety reported the news, and that is the news. It's not their place to editorialize it. Write an op-ed then.
Well, I don't know if it's – I haven't read either piece, but it's not a question of editorializing so much as getting the full picture of the incident, I suppose. You know, if they say, oh, he complains they didn't pay him and now he's suing them, that's not quite the full story if there's the whole back and forth of him agreeing to do the draft because he was attached to direct, he had an oral understanding, blah, blah, blah. You know, if it's more – subtle and nuanced than how Variety originally reported it, then I suppose you can criticize them for that.
Well, and I don't know if he was writing it so much as he was overseeing the writer who was working on the project.
Well, Nick's a writer, so he probably wrote it himself.
Well, I do know that New Line, or the former New Line, is responsible for The Final Destination, which came in first place this week. And you know you're having a bad week in the North American box office when your first place film is down 55% over its earnings from the previous week.
What was new this week?
All About Steve, Gamer, and Extract. Extract got
okay,
mixed
well,
reviews.
Well, there's a reason why The Final Destination is still number one.
Yeah, this is Labor Day weekend. It did better than this weekend last year. It did well for Labor Day weekend. Final Destination is going to be the top grossing Final Destination movie of all time. So this is not a bad showing for the movie or the weekend at all.
Well, it's in its second week. It's a $40 million film, and it's already made $47.4 million in North America.
Success.
Indeed.
Success.
Another successful film, as I'm looking at the box office charts here, 500 Days of Summer, which came in 13th this week, made $1.8 million this week on 935 screens. It's a $7.5 million film, and it's made $27.9 million in North America.
And it's held rock steady. It's made about two. It's now just dipping below 2 million, but it's been on 900 screens and making 2 to 3 million a week. It's definitely, you know, a great little engine that could story.
You're going to have that No Doubt song stuck in my head now for the rest of the day. Thanks ever so much.
I'm delighted for him. I'm also delighted for Inglourious bastards, because this is going to be, I thought it was commercial when I saw it. Everybody else said no. I thought it, I was doubting myself, but it's going to be Tarantino's biggest hit of his career in the U.S. at least.
And everyone's trying to convince me to see it, and I just can't be convinced.
Well, it made $11.6 million this week in North America, and it came in second place. To date, it's made $91.8 million.
And Pulp is only at about 100 and change. It's below 110.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, but remember, yeah. Box office prices, you know, the tickets.
No. It's not that long
ago. Remember also a little guy called Brad Pitt.
Well, John Travolta. Yeah, no, but it's
yeah,
in
but John Travolta wasn't John Travolta then. I
wait
mean,
a second.
Was, but
what does
here.
Brad Pitt have to do with Pulp Fiction?
No, he's in Inglourious. She's saying
Bastards.
He's a draw.
Oh.
Brad, yeah, but to me, Brad Pitt's not a, he's just become a big box office draw, but it doesn't matter. Trenton Tarantino directed the movie. It's his biggest grossing hit of all time. And you know, the 10 years since Pulp Fiction is not a big deal as far as inflation is concerned. That's utterly unimportant. You got to go back 20, 30 years before you worry about, you know, inflation and comparing grosses year to year.
Am I going to have to see this movie? I'm going to have to see
You're going to have to see this
it's
movie.
It's going to get nominated for Oscar. It'll get at least, you know.
Oh, God, I'm going to see this movie.
Christoph Waltz will definitely be nominated for an Academy Award. He plays the Nazi, and he is brilliant, and I think his career should, or hopefully will, take off after this film.
Everybody's talking about him. I'm sure it will.
And
speaking
I,
about talking, we should get our guest on, huh?
Yeah, I mean, do we want to talk about the fact that All About Steve starring your boy Bradley Cooper there, Karen?
I love Brad Cooper. I don't know why he did this movie. I think this movie's been on the shelf for a while. I think that's what's happening.
Well, maybe they should have kept it on the shelf. It opened to $11.2 million in third place. Gamer starring Gerard Butler opened...
Which I saw...
Oh, and you liked it or hated it?
Oh, no, it was dreadful.
Okay, $9.1 million, so you're dreadful.
That's also, I think, been on the shelf for a while.
Extract opened. It's Mike Judge's Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead fame and also of Office Space fame. It earned $4.3 million in and came in ninth place, but it opened on 1,611 screens, so it did not open nearly as wide as some of the other films opening this week.
I disagree. I think that's a wide release for a Jason Bateman starring movie. It could have made... 20, 30 million, 50 million on that many screens. I mean, Borat made how much money on like 900 screens? You know, that's plenty of screens. The box office is because people didn't go see it, which is a shame because it's very funny. It's a really good follow-up to Office Space. It's much better than Idiocracy, which was Mike Judge's last movie. And it's really funny. Letterman loved it. Letterman couldn't stop raving about it. It was funny.
I think it looks funny.
It's amusing. It's very low key, very droll. Jason Bateman's funny. Ben Affleck's funny. It's just
I love Jason Bateman.
It's a nice slow burner of a movie. Lots of funny little lines. It's going to play really well on DVD. You're going to watch it like 10 times and laugh more and more every time. It's that sort of movie.
So it's like Office Space.
Absolutely, it really grows on you. I gave it 3 stars out of 4, but I'm not going to be surprised if I see it again and laugh twice as much and put it on my best of the year list.
Yeah, I think it's one of those that like you go back and you keep finding gems.
Well, you make me want to go see it. I'm going to see if I can look it up this week.
Funny.
Now, I guess you're right, Karen. We should probably get our guests on.
We're joined by two musical guests today. The first one is a longtime friend of mine, Sal Nunziato. He was the co-owner of NYCD, a late and beloved and much missed New York independent record store. Perhaps it was the last independent record store in America. It feels like that lately. And he's also part of a soul band. Called The Cool Jerks. He also blogs online. We'll have the links to Burning Wood tonight, so you can link to that. And Sal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Bob Boylan, and he's really somebody that needs no introduction if you love music. If you love music and you don't know who Bob Boylan is, then please give us your address so we can come and commandeer all of your CDs immediately. He's been with NPR since at least 1988, where he was the director of All Things Considered. He then moved on to, I guess, All Songs Considered is the main podcast, but there's Second Stage, there's a live concerts feed. There, you really have to check out their blog. We will definitely be placing a link to this in the show notes. I'm very excited to have Bob Boylan joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Of course, the reason we have so many musical guests this week is because this week, as movies kind of took a holiday, music did not. The big stories this week were all about music, specifically the Beatles, I guess, whole catalog being released on box set.
That's right. I'm really excited by this, though I'm having trouble getting it. I guess one of the big stories about the box set is how hard it is going to be to buy. First of all, there are no stores left. There are no record stores. And second, there are two versions of the box set, a mono and a stereo. and the mono is only being produced in copies of 10,000 for the North American market. So, Sal, tell us about, are you buying one of the sets or both of them, and why, and was it hard to get?
Well, I am buying both of the sets, and you know, I haven't received them yet. I pre-ordered them from Amazon because that seemed to be the best way to go. Even my old distributor, who I used to work with for 15 years at the store, got very few. So he couldn't even get me one, and most of the people who did order are not going to be getting the mono set. So, which is really surprising to me because, you know, it is to me the most important, you know, musical catalog out there. But even so, and with the economy and the cost of the box set, I'm really surprised that 10,000 just went that quickly. And it is the Beatles, and 10,000 is not a lot worldwide. It's still at $240, but you know, it is the Beatles. So maybe everybody out there really knows what they're doing.
I've been living with the mono and the stereo since Friday.
But first of all, can you guys explain what the mono track is for somebody like me who has no idea what we're talking about?
Okay, so in 1963 through 68, the primary way that you would listen to music was in one speaker. There was no stereo radio. Most people who had turntables that had one speaker. So the primary all the mixes, the ones that they cared about, came out in mono. And so when the Beatles did a record and they did a mix, the mono was where they put all their love and time. The stereos were afterthoughts, and that was true even up through Sgt. Pepper. The Beatles sat in on the Sgt. Pepper mono mixes, as of course did George Martin, but then they left. They went on vacation, and George Martin did the stereo mix in a very short order, very short period of time. So authenticity-wise, mono's the way. That said, I spent yesterday listening to every mono mix, and I'm now up through Help in the stereo land, and I have to say I'm in love with the stereo more.
Really? Why is that?
They're more fun. You can catch it. I mean, the old stereo mixes up through about Revolver, well, not including Revolver, basically had instruments on the left and voices on the right, not completely, but, you know, in big generalization, that's the way it was. And so you hear a lot of the detail, a lot of the harmony and the detail comes out because coming out of two speakers, you can really hear things in much more depth than you do in the mono mix. Remember, you know, these things were done for AM radio. That's what the mix is for. So the punch and everything was coming through a single speaker. But the stereo is much more, it's a bigger treat.
Well, I know you caused a little bit of a ruckus in the middle of the week when you, on your Twitter account, now your Twitter account is All Songs, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. That's it.
And I guess you mentioned that you were downloading the songs off of a secure website, downloading all of the Beatles music off of a secure website, which of course led every tech podcaster and tech blogger and music blogger out there to say, oh my goodness, Apple iTunes is going to have the Beatles starting on September 9th after their big press announcement, because Bob Boylan said so.
Yeah, well, I didn't really. So yeah, I mean, my hope was that on 9/9/09, you know, when Apple themselves, not Apple Records, but Apple Computers, they're doing a big press thing, everybody's hope was, well, of course, this is going to be Beatles and iTunes, finally. It's a negotiation that's been ongoing for absolute years. I've made a lot of phone calls and done a lot of checking. And, of course, you know, nothing is true until the ninth is over. But from what everything I can tell, iTunes and the Beatles are not yet to happen. And that's the announcement on 9/9 are going to be about, you know, new iPods and other things, but not about the Beatles.
Well, let's get a little old school for a second. Sal, it seems to me like the main thing the record companies have left going for them is repackaging old music, like the Beatles box sets in both mono and stereo. Earlier this year, I plunked down more money than I have in ages for Neil Young's set on Blu-ray. And it seems like half the things I buy are just repackaging of old albums.
Well, yeah, that does seem true. You know, there's a lot out there that we still haven't heard. I mean, with unreleased material and, you know, the after fact now, the disappointing thing about the Neil Young archive box, not necessarily the Blu-ray version, but the straight CD version, is that soon after, the first four individual records came out, remastered, repackaged. And if you actually take that music off of the archive box, as well as the live disc that had already been released, you wound up paying $100 retail for about 15 unreleased songs. So for me, you know, repackaging is great if it's truly something you don't have and it truly does sound better. In the case of the Neil Young, you know, if record companies are going to continue to charge that much money when you could have just bought the individual CDs for $11, $12, then we got a problem. And I don't see how anybody is going to keep the industry alive by just repackaging, and repackaging.
But you know, the majority of money that's made in stores from CDs is made through catalog. It's not made through new releases, you know, and so that's really it's really important for them to keep that stuff alive. In one way, you could look at the Beatles box, and you can even think of Neil Young. But I think of the Beatles boxes, maybe for a lot of people, the last CDs they'll ever buy.
I guess the problem I had with the Neil Young was not necessarily the repackaging, but was the re-release of the individual soon after charging so much for something that people have been waiting for. The Beatles, in the meantime, it's been 22 years since those first CDs, and I can't see how, you know, any of this is going to be anything but amazing. You know, just the Neil Young thing seemed to be, you know, just for the CD portion, seemed to be a little disappointing and overpriced. If they didn't release the individual CDs for $11.99, then the box set would have been fantastic. But you know, not everybody wanted to drop that much money at the same time.
One thing about the music, the Beatle music, if you want to go there at all, the quality, I did a lot of A-B comparisons to, you know, the records versus the CD releases that came out 22 years ago versus the mono stereo, and the quality of the music is so much better than certainly better than the CD transfers that they did back in 80 what was it 80
help me out
with 87 I believe
and there's so much more punch in the bass. Everything's much warmer, it's crisper without being harsh. It is really beautiful.
Bob, I officially hate you for having had those box sets and being able to listen to them all over the weekend.
I'm sorry to say.
We'd be playing Beatles Rock Band as well?
You know, somebody's trying to make me, so I don't. We'll see. It's not my thing.
The sad thing is they'll probably make more money off Beatles Rock Band than most other music releases this year.
Beatles Rock Band actually costs about the same, if not more, than the box sets of the music themselves.
No, it doesn't cost $200.
$250.
That's only if you're buying the whole set for the first time.
Ah, okay. Well, as somebody who doesn't play video games, I'd have to buy the whole
set.
Yeah,
no, I don't think that's right. But now, Sal, tell me, if you were going to walk out onto the street to buy the Beatles box set in stereo, where would you go in New York City?
You know, that's a great question, Michael. I guess the first place I would try to, you know, go to is any one of the smaller stores that is still available, possibly Academy. But it's really becoming a sad state. I mean, you go into any one of the Village record stores, which used to be so, I mean, talk about, you know, a toy store for adults. And there's so little in there, and I don't know how many of those stores are actually going to get box sets. You know, they may not have been able to order, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 at you know, whatever the wholesale cost is. You know, so it's going to be tough. I think, you know, sorry to say, after all these years, that online is the way to go, unless there's a resurgence again. Let's open up a record store and sell vinyl, you know.
And the record chains are gone. There's no Tower. There's no HMV. There's no Virgin. Bob, where do you shop? Amoeba?
I don't. I mean, you know, I'm in an unusual situation. I get bins and bins of CDs. This is more fodder for hating Bob. I get bins of CDs in the mail. You know, that come to me, and I'm, you know, if I turn around and look, I have 4 mail crates full of unlistened to. CDs, and that's just the ones that I haven't put on the wall. That's, you know, another 7 or 8 mail crates. So hate me now, send the letters, all songs.
But even when I get tons of CDs, I still can't help trawling the record stores, especially for catalog, at least in the old days when Tower Records was still around. That's a habit you just don't have to be in, I guess.
I have to say, Bob does have a job that I think most music lovers would kill for.
I have bodyguards.
I certainly would.
You have body armor? Is that what you said?
But I didn't say body armor, but that's a good idea. Maybe bodyguards is what I said. But obviously.
Well, and to clarify for people, the Beatles Rock Band is $60 for Nintendo Wii or Xbox 360 or PlayStation. So it's a limited, they have like more expensive limited editions or things where you're buying extra stuff with a guitar and things, and that can cost $100 or $250. But the game itself is $60.
So how many songs do you get on the game? I don't even know how that works.
They have locked onto it 40. They have about 40 songs that are available on it to run through. That you can, you know, obviously, as people know with Rock Band and Guitar Hero, you can sing along or you can play drums, you play guitar, you can do whatever the actual, they list the songs on there, such as I Saw Her Standing There, Day Tripper, Taxman, I Am the Walrus, so you can hear
Octopus's
people going,
Garden.
Octopus's
Garden, yeah, and many more. Here Comes the Sun, which will be played at my funeral, and many other songs.
Are you planning on having a funeral anytime soon?
No, but you got to get that stuff down in advance.
Well, there's which version do you want, though, the mono or the stereo? That's the,
which would you recommend, the mono or the stereo version?
Well, actually, that was a ruse, because there actually is no mono version.
Right.
Well, speaking of funerals, it's all very ironic that the Beatles should be making such a huge comeback during a year when one of the people who owns their catalog was Michael Jackson. And, of course, he was buried on Thursday at Forest Lawn.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, who's making the money off of all of this? Just the publishers? Or, I mean, how much are, you know, Paul and Ringo getting?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of us know that, but you can bet the Capitol's making a good bundle.
I thought Paul was just recently interviewed, like a couple of days or so after Michael's death, where he said the catalog was coming, the publishing was coming back to him.
No, that was a rumor that just one of the 10 million rumors that came out right after the death was that Michael had willed his catalog to Paul McCartney, which he didn't even have the legal right to do. The people that own a big chunk of that catalog that he mortgaged off to keep his lifestyle going have the first right to buy that, and they're going to buy that, and Paul McCartney won't be able to get within a mile of it, I'm afraid.
Well, I do want to say that there is some kind of a date where it reverts back to the Beatles, or did I just make that up?
No, there's a date where stuff goes into the public domain, but not reverting back to the Beatles, unless they buy the catalog again. They sold away their publishing rights.
Yet again, Karen, you are starting rumors. You know, just a few moments ago, you were talking, Michael, about the kind of death of the record store, and certainly reading all of your writing, Sal, the New York Times op-ed piece, your Newsweek piece, lots of stuff on your blog, which is really interesting, by the way, especially if you're into New Orleans music. I couldn't help but think that yes, this is all very true that online killed online killed the record store. But at the same time, it's also helped me as a music lover learn about hundreds, if not thousands, of new artists that I never would have learned about or heard if it hadn't have been for online. And I can't imagine that there is a better time to be an independent musician. And certainly, Bob, you're a musician and you're part of the reason a lot of independent musicians are heard these days. Is there a replacement for the record store?
I don't necessarily believe that online killed the record store. Even in the op-ed piece, we sort of blame the major labels, the high list pricing, the death of the single, where people just couldn't go out and spend, you know, $3 for the two songs that, you know, that they liked off of a mostly inferior, you know, full-length CD. It's a little of everything. It's not just necessarily online. But now being so far removed from the store, because it's been 4 years since I shut my doors, I agree with you in terms of, you know, searching for new bands, new music, getting your music heard. Online is the internet is just amazing. It's absolutely amazing what you can find, what's available, the resources for you know, not only commercially released stuff, but unreleased material off each individual artist's blogs. It's phenomenal. I think the only way to make that better is if the music became a little more accessible. I mean, so often you have to sign up and then you have to, you know, log into this and go into that. And it really should be, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this now after having the store for so long and missing terribly record stores and the mom and pops. But, you know, Amazon with their little MP3 store, it is so easy and so inexpensive and it's so quick. And that's what was great about a record. You went in, you went to a record store, you were able to browse, look at everything, pick 5 or 10 things if you're really going nuts, and boom, you're left with all this music.
You know, I spent many years in record stores, not just shopping, but working in them, running, you know, managing them and being a buyer and all that stuff. And I think if you're given the choice of being 15 years old in, you know, 1972 or whatever, and being 15 years old now, I'd rather be 15 years old now. As much as I loved when I was working at a store, people coming up to me and recommending stuff, as much as I loved going into stores and knowing the people I would go to and trust in their music tastes, it is so much better now. You can find so many people writing about music and discovering it. I think this is a wonderful universe. And as much as I love the record store, I love this world now. And the other part of that is the music is every bit as good, if not better, than it's ever been.
I think a large part of that is because people can create music in their bedrooms now.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think, Sal, you with your blog, in a way, you're kind of continuing the role you played at a record store by saying, hey, here's a great New Orleans band. Here's some great music. And Bob, certainly that's what you're doing with All Songs Considered and Second Stage and the Tiny Desk Concerts. It's, in a way, you're being the record store purveyor by saying, here's something of note. Take a listen. And you're not only able to say it, you're actually able to play it for us.
You know, Bob said something great where he said, you know, the music is better than ever now. And I totally agree with that. There's always something great out there if you just take the time and look for it. And one of the most irritating things for me in the last days of the store was when people would just look around and say, well, there's really nothing new out there. There's nothing good to buy. And I always used to you know, turn into the cranky record store clerk. Or not turn into, just that's how I exist every day, actually. But I used to say, of course there's something to buy. You know, there's always something out there. It just seems that people, you know, were deterred by the cost and so many other problems. But the internet, searching out music, it is truly better than ever.
Well, Bob, what are some of the music that you've discovered this year that you're sharing with people, encouraging them to check out?
Let's see. I mean, what I listened to today so far, besides the Beatles, there's a record by a group called the Dry Spells that I quite like. They're a San Francisco band. They have sort of roots a little bit in Fairport Convention and then a little bit in television. But so it's a mix of folk and really good rock music. There's an artist called Taken by Trees that I like a lot. Taken by Trees is a woman who was a lead singer of a Swedish band called The Concretes, and she went to Pakistan and made a record, a Swedish pop in Pakistan, and it's just this absolutely gorgeous thing called Taken by Trees. I could make a really long list.
What about artists like Passion Pit or some of the other big indie artists that kind of came to the everybody's attention this year? Phoenix, I guess, would be a classic in my mind.
Yeah, there's a lot of good synthy pop bands that are making very strong records. And you just mentioned two of them. MGMT is another one.
Actually, MGMT does our, as if they did it for us, but we use them.
Oh, you use kids, right?
Yeah, we use kids. Yeah, that's right. And at the end of every show, we tell people where they can see them this week.
And Sal, what are some of your favorite albums out this year?
Well, unfortunately, they're probably records that are not by brand new, young, up and coming artists. But the thing that's been kicking my butt lately is the new Black Crowes record that just came out. That was recorded up at Levon Helm's barn. It really, truly, to me, sounds like what the band may be doing if they were just a little harder, a little stronger. I love this new. There's a new Roseanne Cash record coming out next month.
The list.
That it's a collection of songs actually that her dad Johnny had written out for her and said you need to know these songs. It was 100 songs, and she chose a dozen of them, and it's brilliant. So I'm really digging that. And then there's this other record that just came out in England called Seven Worlds Collide, which is a project with Neil Finn, Wilco, some members of Radiohead, and it's a benefit for Oxfam. And it's all new material by you know, with each of these artists collaborating on each other's songs.
How do you guys find new music these days? Because certainly you are helping start trends in music by recommending certain music. How is it that you're finding and locating this music?
Bob opens his mail.
actually, intern opens the mail, and then and then throws away. Actually, puts in the recycle bin every press release that I get. Puts the CDs in a big mail bin for me, and I just pull them out. I put on the first song, and if I don't like the first song, I'm done. I go to the next CD. If I like the first song, I go to the second song. If the second song's good, I rip it, put it in my iTunes, and drive around with it. That's my method.
So then there is some truth to put your best song first.
Man, if you don't, you're crazy. I mean, for so many reasons, you know, and listening to the Beatle records, that was very, very clear. Their first songs on their records were killer songs, as was the first song on the second side of the record as well, which is one thing I wish they had done on these remasters. I wish they had put like about 6 seconds between side A and side B, you know, just that amount of time that it would have taken to go to the record and turn it over. It would have been a nice thing.
Sal, how do you find your music?
It's scouring the internet, various websites, new release sites. I read Mojo religiously and look at the, you know, up and coming releases, the reviews in the back. You know, it used to be where that great long lost wonderful newsletter, the ICE newsletter, which used to come out monthly. It, for me, that was the greatest day of the month when that came in the mail, because it really told you everything. Now, unfortunately, you just have to do the research yourself. But you know, Amazon again. I hate to keep throwing that name out there, but it's easy and it's helpful. There's another great blog called Pause and Play that sends out an email weekly of the new releases, both reissues as well as first time, with links to where to buy them, people's blogs and websites. So you just got to look for it, basically. I don't get much mail.
What do you think is going to happen to record companies? It seems Radiohead has already dispatched their record company. They're not even on a label anymore, and they're releasing their music online. What is the future of the record company? What value do they bring to the mix?
I think that they've been obviously terribly, terribly slow to the come to bat here, but they do offer a lot for an artist to get their name out there. I mean, you know, look, there are just more ways, but I don't think there's the death of the record company happening. I think there are just many more ways to do it, and they're not the only game in town, which is what they were. Even large labels, you know, Atlantic just signed a band called Fanfarlow, a band I've been, you know, loving and following for a couple of years now, and they're out there seeking. They know it's important to grab up these new bands. I like. I mean, what Jill did was very unique, which is she said, "Hey, fans, I want to put out a record, and I don't have enough money, so help me out, and you'll get something in return." Another good model. And I mean, yeah,
this was who?
That's something that the
Jill
the Threadheads in New Orleans. The Threadheads are a group of people that were longtime jazz fest goers in New Orleans, and they approached one of their favorite artists, John Boutte, and said, you know, why don't you put out a new record? He said, well, we don't have any money. And sure enough, they collected the money and funded the first record for John Boutte and Paul Sanchez. And now Threadhead Records has put out 8 releases with another 6 coming, all fan-funded.
This sounds a lot like Obama's socialism taking over our music industry. People funding each other's albums. Yeah, I think you still need record companies, because who else is going to pay for the payola?
But you're not a cynic.
Well, now, Bob, you just mentioned Fanfarlow. Everything that I've heard from Fanfarlow is fantastic. I believe their album comes out later this year.
You know what? I thought it was out, but
maybe,
yeah,
it is.
We get things a couple of months in advance. I think their album is out.
Is there any music that either of you are looking forward to that will be released later this year?
I just read about this set that's coming out on Rhino. It's I believe it's called Rod Stewart's Session Man. And what interested me about this thing is that it's a collection of all these early alternates, unreleased, and outtakes from the great classic period, 71, 72, 73. And with all the reissues that have come out and catalog reissues by so many artists, I've never seen any sort of wealth of bonus tracks on any one of the Rod Stewart reissues, so who knew that this stuff existed? So now we're going to get three full CDs worth of classic Rod. I mean, of course, it's alternates and outtakes, so they may not be anywhere near what has been officially released, but I'm still a little excited about that.
And that's a four CD set, and that comes out on September 29th.
There's a new Flaming Lips record coming. Also, the Bon Iver, people know about Justin Vernon, maybe they know about, I don't know. He's got a new project called Volcano Choir that's rather experimental and wonderful. New Mountain Goats record's really good. And they just played my desk the other day, and that was fun. I'm just going through stacks here without trying to turn away from the microphone.
We can hear you. It's so funny.
Christina Train is another record that's coming out that I can't wait for.
What kind of music is that?
She is a singer-songwriter. I think Nashville, but don't quote me on that. But Blue Note is releasing it. It looks as if it's being marketed as yet another Norah Jones. But from what I've heard, and you could stream the whole record on BlueNote.com, it is really the closest thing to a Dusty Springfield record. More so than Shelby Lynn, more so than Norah Jones, more so than Duffy, just absolutely phenomenal voice, all original material, really, really sexy and exciting.
The Volcano Choir album comes out September 22nd, and how do you spell Christina Train for people who want to look her up online?
It's Christina with a K, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, and Train, T-R-A-I-N-N, T-R-A-I-N.
Well, now, that's something, you know, Bob, you kind of touched on the fact that people come straight to your desk. These musicians will come straight to your desk and play little tiny concerts right at your desk.
It came from this thing. It happened, and we went to the South by Southwest a few years ago, and one of our favorite artists, this woman, Laura Gibson, was playing. She's like the quietest singer on planet Earth, and it was the noisiest room you could imagine, too. Nobody was listening to her. And when she came off stage, you know, I introduced myself and said, you know, I really love you, but I couldn't hear a word you sang. And Stephen Thompson, who's a producer here at NPR, was with me. And he said, well, you ought to, next time you come through Washington, you ought to come and play at Bob's desk. Of course, you know, half joking. And she was touring with the Decemberists opening, and she was coming to Washington. She called up and said, I'm on my way. So we started a concert series. We'd have two high-definition cameras and a really nice stereo mic, and people play three songs, four songs. We just had Glenn Hansard and Marketa Iglova, the folks from the movie Once, come here. They played six brand-new songs from a record that comes out in, what, 4 weeks?
And that's the amazing thing of technology.
Tried getting people over to the living room, but no one's accepted yet.
Well, that's the amazing thing of technology, that Bob can do that. And Daryl Hall has found a second career doing an online show where he hosts guests and have them, they perform together and they stream it online. The possibilities that technology has opened up is great.
Something I heard recently was that there are some record executives that believe that music will just be free in a couple of years, and that all of the money will be made off of concerts and t-shirts and all the merchandise. How true do you think that is?
And certainly amongst the sorts of people that I like to listen to and deal with, you know, people who are selling under 30,000 copies of a record, that's how they make their money. And I think it's a fine way for a musician to make their money, frankly.
Is that really a hit these days? I mean, years ago, somebody once told me that if you sell 40,000 records, you are considered a hit. I mean, that you're not considered a Bruce Springsteen or... I don't know.
That was not a hit for a major record label, not at all. Right. You'd have to sell 500,000 copies or platinum before the artist would see any money.
But how, I mean, the Decemberists you mentioned, how many records are they selling?
Well, you know, you can bet they're in the way over the 100,000 mark, but not when they were doing their small records on a small label. You know, if they sold 20,000, 30,000 copies, they did well. And, you know, Andrew Bird, who makes the top 10 in Billboard now, Probably that first week sold, 20,000 copies of a record, maybe. So, but that's good,
Yeah, 20,000 copies of a record 20 years ago was enough to get you dropped.
That's right.
Yeah, you can get into the top 200 of the Billboard charts by selling like 1,000 or 2,000 copies of your album. I've often fantasized about getting together some pod, some online only album, getting all my friends to buy it and being able to make the Billboard charts.
You get 2,000 people
buy it in 1 week. I'm on the Billboard top 200. Well, yeah, I'll be there for the rest of history. They'll have to list me as hitting the Billboard top 200.
Right before they play Here Comes the Sun at your funeral.
Well,
where do you both see the music industry, at least the recording industry, headed?
I know that musicians become more and more frustrated about recording. A friend of mine who's will remain nameless, but he's pretty successful and had put out 3 new records over the course of 5 years, was successful on Broadway, had 2 very successful Broadway musicals that he wrote the music for, had called me up and said, I really want to go back into the studio. I have some new material, but what's the point? And that was such a disheartening thing to hear. And I said, well, what does that mean? He says, well, I don't have the money to pay for the recording. And when I'm done, no one's going to, search it down. No one's going to publicize it. No one's going to hear it. And I just, why bother doing it? And this is a guy who was nominated for a Tony. It becomes so frustrating when there are so few outlets aside from the internet, which, by the way, is gigantic and phenomenal and amazing and nothing but helpful. But where it's going to go from this point on, I don't know. Are CDs going to still be made? I don't know. Probably not. I don't see that. I don't see CDs being around much longer. So are the records going to go straight to streams or straight to websites and downloadable files? Anything is possible.
This is just a pet peeve of mine, but any artist who doesn't go into the studio because they're afraid that their records aren't going to sell, I don't know. I mean, you make a record because you have to. At least I think those are the records that are made that are the best records, and you don't think of the outcome. You just make it because that's what's inside of you, and you got to make it. I keep coming back to the same thing. I get asked a lot about the music business and where's the music business going, and all I keep coming back to is, hey, man, I want to be 15 years old and get have all these possibilities that are open to me. And as a musician, I'd like to be, a 15 years old with the hope that I can make music and I can just put it out there and see what happens. That possibility didn't exist before. And so you can talk all you want about the record labels and what's going to happen to the business and all that stuff. But from a standpoint of a fan, from the standpoint of a musician, and that's the standpoint we should care about, it's never been better.
Well, and you record music and release it on your website, bobboylan.info is where you can find it. You give it away for free.
Yeah, and I don't care who hears it. I don't care if nobody hears it. I have to make this music. This is what I need to do with my life and my time and what comes out of me, and I just do it and I just give it away. And I had 2 paths I can go down to when I was in my 20s and in rock bands. I could have gone down the path of becoming a musician and trying to make money at it. What I chose to do instead was try to find a way to find great music and put it in the hands of people. And it took me a while to do that. So that's what I do, and I decided that I wanted to divorce myself of music and money and not make music because I had to worry about where it's going to sell. I just wanted to make music. And, artists have that choice.
I don't think it was necessarily just that for my friend, deciding, no one's going to hear it, and so I'm not going to record it. And I'm sure that he wound up going into the studio and doing something, and he continued to make music. But I think it was part of it. It was a factor, along with all the other things, that it's become more frustrating, or at the time, which is not that long ago, he may have felt like, I'm just coming off of 2 Tony nominations, and that's not enough for me to draw any interest at all into, what I'm doing. I don't disagree with what you're saying, Bob, in terms of, being a great time for young people and getting music out there. I guess just as an old schooler and a guy who's been buying records for almost 40 years, I see it, you know, I see it one way for me. You know, it's like I wanted something and I knew I was able to go out and get it. And now it's just, you know, a few extra steps to try to search something down as opposed to it having coming to me the way it used to be in a record store.
I can remember my days in the record store where, you know, I wanted to get those Nick Drake records, but damn it if I can find them. And it wasn't until, you know, I was actually a buyer in a record chain that I could order them from Gem Records, which is an import company back then, and get them into stores. I mean, it wasn't always easy to find that stuff. I used to go to New York to scour record bins to, you know, to find the imports that you couldn't get in America. So, you know, there was a...
And you couldn't get anyone to buy that CD until they put the Nick Drake music on a Volkswagen ad. But as a freelance writer, I think maybe the one thing the musician Sal was talking about was bemoaning was the idea of music being sort of central to the discussion. As a freelancer, it's really hard for me to pitch stories about bands right now. People are not running the same stories. They're not talking about music as much. And if people think, oh, there's not a lot of great music out there, it's because the newspapers and the magazines and the TV and all that, they're just not focusing on music a lot. It's not really, it's hard to break through the noise of websites and YouTube and video games and Twitter and all that to get people talking about all the great music that really is out there. But I think the music is headed back to the clubs because everything I hear, people still go to the clubs. They have to go see live music. Your artists are going to be playing smaller venues than ever because they're not selling 3 or 4 million copies. Every artist is going to have a record studio in their home. So I think they're going to be able to put out their music and you're going to get to see them live. And that's the best way to see music of all.
I agree.
So, how do you do that in this economy when what my friend likes to refer to as fake Journey, because it's not Steve Perry, but an incredible look and sound alike, well, they charge $125 a ticket. I mean, you know, unless you're really going to the clubs where it's, you know, $6, $7, $10 to see a few different bands, even the smaller venues with the smaller names are charging 2 and 3 times more than what it used to be. And it's become more difficult that way as well.
Well, you're in New York, and the Beacon is overpriced, and the jazz clubs like Blue Note have always been exorbitantly expensive. I don't go there unless I get tickets for free. But for most of the country, you can see a lot of really good bands for inexpensive money. You know, I'm still seeing Matthew Sweet and Richard Thompson in clubs. I can see Lyle Lovett in small spaces. I can see, you know, they're everywhere. Ben Queller, you know. Regina Spektor might have played Radio City, but she'll come back around and she'll play a much smaller venue because that's better for her.
Or you could tune into Bob's podcast, the Live Concerts podcast, which is absolutely amazing. I have to say, it's one of my favorite podcasts.
Thanks.
Because, I mean, I could not get tickets to see Tom Waits in Los Angeles. That's like, you know, you have to donate body parts to get a ticket to see Tom Waits if and when he ever comes to Los Angeles. However, you had him on, I guess, the Live Concerts podcast, and there was a whole 2.5-hour show. It was fantastic.
Which they mixed just for us. I mean, it was, you know, there's a couple of things here that you bring out that I'm thinking about. One is that when we talk about, we started a live concert series is, you know what, 2005. When we first approached our very first band, which was Bright Eyes, you know, they kind of said, oh, live concert, stream of live concerts, oh, okay. And then the next band we approached was Wilco, and they said, I don't know. But they said, okay. And people weren't sure about it. And now my email box is filled with bands who are saying, we're coming to town. Can we be on your series? In other words, what I mean by that, why I point that out, is that people understand the most important thing is to get your music into the ears of listeners. And it's not, as record companies always thought, was to hold tight this music and make there just be one way, well, radio being the second way, of hearing the music. So, and that goes for record companies changing as well. We have a series called First Listen Series where you stream an entire album for about a week. The first people who approached us, we didn't even have this idea. We got approached by Columbia Records, you know, a monster record label, big. You think of big companies, they're the biggest, or one of them. And they came to us with Bob Dylan. And they said, we have this new Bob Dylan record, which was
Telltale Signs?
That's it, yes.
Telltale Signs.
Thank you. And they said, would you like to stream this whole thing on your website? And we're like, this is Columbia? This is Bob Dylan? This is new. This is big. This is different. They're thinking different. These are signs that things are changing. when they called us and asked us if we want to do that, my first reaction was, well, send it. We'll listen to it. But we did love it. And we did do it. But these are signs that things are changing, you know, and artists like Tom Waits, artists like Radiohead calling us and saying, we're doing a tour. We would like to have our tour on your website. That's different. That's different attitudes. And these are, you know, I think the beginnings of just a whole new way of artists looking at what they do, not to hold themselves close to the chest, but to get it out there. Because when they get it out there, people then come to their shows.
Well, it certainly beats having them strip search you on the way into the concert because you might have a tape recorder on you. Certainly, Bob, you're going to be hopefully continuing All Songs Considered and the many podcasts that you host and produce. You also have a wonderful blog. And, of course, there's always Monitor Mix, which is Carrie Brownstein's blog. Sal, what are you going to be doing? The record store has been closed for 4 years. I know you've got your blog. You're writing for the Huffington Post and other outlets. Where do you see yourself going now as somebody who loves music?
You know, that's a good question. And if anybody wants to phone in with suggestions for me, I'd appreciate it.
Where's your blog located?
The blog is at www.burnwoodtonight, and tonight is spelled T-O-N-I-T-E. So it's burnwoodtonight at blogspot.com. I would love to continue what I'm doing on a much larger level. There's so much music that I'd love to share. There's so much music out there that people just don't know. I could spend a year just talking about the great music of New Orleans. Theoretically, you know, I have a lot ahead of me.
You just want to be able to pay the bills while you do what you love.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what I'm looking for, and it's really hard to stop what I'm doing because I truly love it. I wake up in the morning, and the first thing, you know, I got to get the music on. As I work and as I write, the music is playing. At night, when I'm, you know, cooking dinner, and the music is playing. It's just, it's such an obsession, and it's a good obsession because it's endless. It's absolutely endless how much is out there. And you know, I'd love to keep pushing it out there and sharing it and getting other people to discover music like I did.
Do you engage people on your blog? Do you have are you building an audience? Is it a back and forth? Is it a one-way conversation? How does your blog work?
No, it's a daily. When it first launched a year ago, just a few days ago, actually, September 2nd was the first anniversary of it. I had welcomed anyone to contribute, you know, and occasionally I do get some people writing in, people sending in music they'd like to post. I've asked for suggestions. What I like to keep it, short, quick, something that's not going to take people too many, you know, minutes of their time to get through. It's really just a way for people to say, wow, I didn't know that this person had a CD out, or wow, I didn't know that person covered, you know, that Tom Waits song. And I put links up so that people not only hear the music on my site, but can then purchase it, check out the artist. I want people to talk to me and really participate.
I look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you.
Certainly, I'd like to thank both of you for participating in this week's episode. It's gone on way longer than I had ever anticipated, but
it's so interesting.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you very much. It's just fun.
Bob, you can be found at npr.org/allsongs, if I'm not mistaken.
That's a good way.
And or bobboylan.info, and your Twitter account is allsongs.
There's an All Songs Facebook fan page, the Bob Boylan All Songs, which I invited people to. Unfortunately, I stuffed, so I can't take any more friends. I got to do something about that. I got to throw some friends. Anybody need some friends? maybe we can do like a start a
sure,
market.
Sure, please.
Trading friends.
Yeah, give them to Sal.
The best thing is we'll have links to all your stuff online in our showbiz notes. And I really appreciate taking the time to talk with us. And we hope to have both of you back on again sometime soon.
Thanks for asking.
Sounds great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Well, I was absolutely ecstatic that both Sal and Bob were able to join us. I'm a huge fan of Bob Boylan. And certainly when I lived in New York, I knew about NYCD and had been in the store a couple of times.
Yeah, no, I've known Sal for many years. I walked into the store, you know, for some bizarre reason in New York, almost all the used record stores were in the Lower East Side on one street on St. Mark's Place.
That's right.
There were a few others elsewhere scattered, mostly classical music or Broadway show tunes. There really were none. And then this record store, NYCD, popped up on the Upper West Side. And I was like, finally, like, of course, you know, there's this huge audience of people that, you know, can walk to it. And walked in and made friends with both the owners, Sal Nunziato and Tony Sachs, who's also a friend of mine. And Tony loves Frank Sinatra, and Sal loves New Orleans, and another guy loved the Grateful Dead. And they didn't make fun of your music purchases, even if it was John Denver. You know, it was just a great – it was your ideal indie record store.
I like the way that he describes it in some of the pieces that we're going to have on the show notes. Was it the New York Times? But it just seems so – like we talked about earlier in the show, so high fidelity, like it's like a community of people who love music, which I think is really cool.
Well, now I know that we've gone on for quite a while. I don't know how much longer we want to keep our listeners. So is there a story that you particularly want to discuss from the show notes this week?
I kind of like the Twitter major fail.
Cool.
This is Fox's Twitter TV experiment tweets its way to epic failure, which was on Fast Company.
What was the experiment, Karen?
They, and Sperling, correct me if I'm wrong, but because I'd never heard of this, so I had to like really actually read this. They ran repeats of Fringe, and they overlaid
Glee.
On it.
And Glee.
And the pilot of Glee.
Okay. They overlaid on it people's Twitter posts on TV, right?
Yes.
Or was it online? It was on TV.
Cast members. It was cast members talking about the show, though. It wasn't like fans, was it?
No. It was fans.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was
fans,
cast members.
Yeah,
it was,
oh.
It was moderated, but I think a lot of people did not like it because it took up just not the lower third of the screen, but larger portions of the screen than they had anticipated. And just last week, we were talking about all of the bugs and ads that are placed on screens these days. It is annoying. And
I'm sure it was like pop-up video, I suppose, is probably how they originally pitched this, how cool this is going to be. It's like pop-up video, but like, you know, America. But just looking at the pictures on this website, you can tell it major fail.
good idea, badly executed.
Yeah.
Well, I know, Karen, you're looking forward to Glee, so I guess you're telling us you don't want them doing another Twitter experiment on a show you're looking forward to.
I find that whole thing very it is distracting. It's like the bugs we talked about last week, but also, it's been really hot here in LA, so I have to keep my windows open. But I live in a busy street, so I have to turn on the subtitles when I want to watch TV.
Wow.
I know, it's really sad, right? And it's so distracting. It's like on one hand, it's like, and it's sort of the same idea as this Twitter thing. On one hand, it's intriguing, or necessary, or what have you, but it creates a whole other element going on the lower half of the screen that you stop watching TV to enjoy yourself and you find yourself having a very stressful interactive experience.
Well, I finally watched the pilot to Glee on Wednesday night when they showed the director's cut. So they are really pushing Glee, but
that's also the one I watched too.
It's also in the iTunes top 10 list still, the pilot for Glee. People are still buying that show online. And I thought it was pretty fun. I'm looking forward to it. I didn't realize one of the leads is Lea Michele, who was in Spring Awakening on Broadway. I've interviewed her, and she's good in her role. And it's fun, and it's got good music. I'm not sure how they're going to pace the show, because by the end of the debut episode, the kids had done this really fun, great performance of Journey's Don't Stop Believin', and that's just the rehearsal. So I'm not sure what they're going to build up to, because they already seem pretty darn polished and great. But it was pretty fun. If I was a kid, I would have loved it, because it's a pretty gay show. But
but it's not like High School Musical lame. It's got an edge to it, and I like it for the same reason that I like 10 Things I Hate About You.
I haven't watched that yet. Is that TV show good? That's the spinoff from the movie that launched Heath Ledger.
Oh, watch it. Yeah, it's
all right,
good.
I will.
Are either of you going to watch, and this is a loaded question because I know the answer, but are either of you going to watch American Idol?
That's in January.
Yes,
of course we are.
But
why are we talking about American Idol, Sperling?
Because Katy Perry and Avril Lavigne are joining Victoria Beckham, Mary J. Blige, Kristen Chenoweth, and Neil Patrick Harris, Joe Jonas, and Shania Twain as guest judges.
Just during the audition, they just have them sit at the table. They've done this before. This isn't new.
Oh, okay.
Even when they had Paula. So yeah, they have celebrity guest judges who sit in during the audition process when people are going to go city to city. It's fine. I like to see Neil Patrick Harris do it, but yeah, I mean, I wish I could be a guest judge, but it's just to put a celebrity face on weeks when there are no big names involved. And I think they're a little panicky about Paula, and they sort of bumped up the quotient of the celebrities a bit. But mm-hmm. I have an announcement to make. Just spreading my wings sort of thing. I just sent you guys a link. It just went live a few hours ago, my very first solo podcast. I did an interview with Matthew Sweet for Huffington Post about his album of duets with Susanna Hoffs of the Bangles. And it's a really fun. It's called Under the Covers, Volume 2. And it's covers of songs from the 70s by people like Fleetwood Mac and Todd Runyon and Mott the Hoople. And Yes, they have this really great cover of a Yes song. And thanks to Sperling's help, I was able to turn it into a podcast. So I took too long to intro. It's like a 6-minute intro, and I play some clips of his music, and then I have a 40-minute chat with Matthew Sweet. So I'm very excited.
So is this going to be like every week? Or?
Well, whenever I get a good interview, that's worthy of going online. And also, I have hundreds of interviews from the past. So if I've been able to do it when Dominic Dunn died, I could have posted my interview with Dominic Dunn. I had a really great chat with him a few years ago. And then any current new artists that I interviewed that I really like. It's just another great way to get people to hear about music, mostly music or movies or TV. But, you know, when I put a post on Huffington, you can show clips of their old videos. You can put links to songs. People can hear the music right away. You can link to the podcast and I can hear the person talking. It's just such a rich way of presenting an artist and their music or whatever the genre might be that online is really ideal for it. And I think Bob and Sal are sort of paving the way in that. In what they're doing online.
Well, you can find the podcast on iTunes, of course. And do you have a website where people can find them?
If you go to michaelgiltz.com, you'll find a link to both the Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes and to my own this podcast.
Well, every week we end with a little segment we call Inside Baseball. And this week we have something that I found a little interesting. I know a couple of weeks ago we talked about Bud Schulberg, the author and screenwriter who died at the age of 95. He was, of course, the screenwriter for On the Waterfront, as well as numerous other films. He won an Oscar for On the Waterfront. He also wrote the best-selling novel What Makes Sammy Run, which Ben Stiller had been trying to turn into a film for something like 13 years. And there was an article in the Los Angeles Times, Patrick Goldstein's column, The Big Picture. He talked about receiving a kind of fake interview between Ben Stiller and the writer he had hired, Jerry Stahl, who wrote Permanent Midnight. I guess Permanent Midnight was based on his life.
Yeah.
I love the way Patrick starts this article. One of the great Hollywood mysteries of recent vintage, right up there with how Adrian Brody ever won an Oscar and why Universal Pictures thought it should spend $100 million on a hapless comedy like Land of the Lost, is whatever happened to Ben Stiller's decade-long crusade to bring Bud Schulberg's fabled What Makes Sammy Run to the big screen. Stiller and Stahl sat down and interviewed one another about what went wrong, but in doing so, they talk a lot about Bud Schulberg and their relationship with him, and it's a really fascinating read.
Well, I look forward to checking that out. I interviewed Jerry Stahl in Ben Stiller's apartment in New York. Jerry was in New York to promote a novel of his, a follow-up to Permanent Midnight, and he was staying at Ben Stiller's apartment, so I got to see what Ben Stiller's place looked like.
And?
It was nice. Much nicer than mine.
I'll bet.
I'm not sure if I'm right about it. I think the poster on the wall was Sweet Smell of Success, one of the great movies of all time, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, Michael, I know we just mentioned where people could read you at popsurfing.com or at michaelgiltz.com. And your Twitter handle is Michael Giltz. Very complicated there. Karen, your Twitter handle is something like KW39875.
It's KWoody3939.
And of course, they can also read you on Industry Nexus.
That's right.
We also have to thank our guests, including Sal Nunziato, who can be found on his blog, Burnwood Tonight. We will place a link on the show notes. And Bob Boylan, who is on Twitter and on the NPR website, npr.org/allsongs, or you can find him on Twitter. His handle is allsongs. If you want to find links to any of the stories that we talked about on this episode, you can do so by visiting our website, showbizsandbox.com, and look them up in the show notes. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us with feedback or send us news tips or just send us love notes, you can do so. The address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail with similar information. The phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. If you want to send us news stories, you can do so through the social bookmarking website, delicious.com. Just tag any link that you send us with Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode is by a band that Bob brought up, MGMT. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or myspace.com/MGMT. And if you want to see them, they are performing this week, September 8th, at Technopolis, which is in Athens, Greece, at 7 p.m. They will also be at the Isle of Wight at Bestival, whatever that is. Anything else, guys?
That's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Karen, Michael. Until next week, play nice.